Good morning. So last time we talked more about building CPUs. We started talking about, well, we have this component to make decisions. We have muxes, which allow us to decide between one of two options. And this was our essential building block for our processors, where we would run one instruction per cycle, and during that cycle we had multiple things we wanted to both, say, be connected to our register file to write. We wanted to write one value in one case from, you know, say the ALU, and in another case we wanted to write the value that, say, came from the memory. And we wanted to make a decision between the two, so we used a mux. So during the cycle, the mux would choose which of the two inputs actually went to the register file. And by doing this, we have our processor, which can actually execute all sorts of instructions, looking at what the instruction is to decide exactly what ends up happening. Now, then we said, well, we want to actually sort of build this, and having pictures of our processor is a workable thing, but it's not really going to scale. You know, it's not a very precise way of specifying our processor. It's not a way that we're going to want to use when we start implementing all the instructions, most likely, and have to worry about specifying all the possibilities and seeing where wires go. So instead, we have a text-based description. So we're describing our circuits with text. And we have our custom programming language, HCLRS, for this class, which is based on the one in our book. It still makes this assumption that you're always building a x86 processor. So we saw that, like, we had the instruction memory, which was always active. We had the output showing us all the registers in the register file, and also disassembling the instructions we read from the instruction memory, though the instructions being disassembled didn't mean that we actually wrote the code to make the instructions do anything. Okay. And we're going to finish up talking about HCL today. So last time when we left off, we were just getting to sort of our simple CPUs. We had our CPU that did, like, just nops or just jumps, and then we talked about implementing muxes, where we had our syntax that looks something like this, where we had a open bracket and a list of options which are evaluated in order, kind of like if, else if, else if, and so on. And this example, this is this implementation of a nop or jump CPU, also has some other features which are notable sort of convenience things in HCL. So our first examples, we just said, oh, I want to get what we're calling the I code. That's the part of the instruction which tells us whether it's a nop or some kind of register to register move or some kind of jump. And here, we're giving a name to that. So we have this syntax where we declare what we call a wire. So in HCL parlance, a wire is actually a wire bundle. Remember, we talked about a bundle of wires, one for each bit. And here, I'm saying I have a wire of 4 bits called iCode, a wire of 64 bits called dest, and a wire valp of 64 bits. And I'm declaring my register for the PC like before. And I'm extracting my iCode from here, from my instruction memory output, implementing this split box, and naming it iCode so I don't type i10 bytes 4 to 8 here, and here, and here, and here, and here. I just give sort of a preview for that once. And similarly, I'm computing the address of the next instruction, and I just call that valp rather than naming it, you know, rather than referring to that directly to the P of the PC here, that doesn't really help us any, but when we have a more complete processor, maybe you want to use the address of the next instruction in multiple places. If you want to know why you'd want to do that, think of the call instruction. Now we have a way of doing that. And similarly, I have dest for the jump destination, and so on. And something worth noting that I do here is that I have my default case. I put this weird hex value. Obviously, that's not a meaningful hex value. This is a convention I recommend rather than putting a zero there, because this way, when I run it and I find out why am I executing all these instructions at address bad, 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 I can figure it out. Whereas if I ran this and said, why am I executing all these instructions at address zero for no reason, that's going to be a lot harder to debug. So I recommend setting default cases with some obvious value like that. And we saw, I believe, running this on an example here. And note that you can read the SimAssembly. So let's go back to our demo, which is here. Okay. So here's our not jump CPU, basically the same code. And here's my not jump.ys, my assembly file. And I produced that into a not jump.yo, which is my assembled version. So I have the hex of the instructions. Note that the hex is written with the first byte first in the line. It's not a number, like, not in the numerical order that you'll get as far as if you printed out the value of i10 bytes. It's just the first byte in memory is in the first column and so on. And we saw running this with, so not jump cpu.hcl, we saw running this here, and we saw that we have the value of the PC after every point in time, and also the contents of memory and the contents of all the registers, which isn't very interesting right now. So there's some other things we can do to maybe help us figure out how our processor is doing, which is going to be helpful in cases where you write some HCL code and you run it like this and you see cycles run like 500, what went on, that's not supposed to happen. You want to know what's going on. Yes, you can redirect this output to a file. So that's one option, so to output.txt. And then I can open that up in a text editor of my choice and you see, okay, I could scroll through that. But that might be hard to figure out what's going on from that. So we have an option to get more debug output. So dash D or dash dash debug. So I'll do it with just D. And this is going to give us more information. So let's look at what that output looks like. So here's some of our debugging output, and it shows us, first of all, what happens with the instruction memory. It's explicit that i10 bytes had this value because the PC had this value, the signal name PC, which remembers the control for where do we read an instruction from this cycle. And it also shows us what the final value just before the rising edge of the clock of every single wire that we have a name for is. This is another advantage of defining wires. Since I defined an iCode, I can just read out from here, oh, iCode was 0x1. And I can look through this to figure out all my values that were computed. Note that this is in alphabetical order, so you can find something in the list if you need it. And this occurs after every cycle that we simulate. So for the next cycle where the PC is 1, we find out that this is what was read from the instruction memory, which is our jump instruction and some extra stuff after it. And we can see that the I code is 0x7 for jump, and so on. So any questions about this debug output? So that's our debug output, which I redirected. So you can get the debug output, you can redirect it to a file with a syntax like this. This is just a shell feature. So I could do that and then view the file. There's also a feature if you find, you know, that you don't want to just run the whole thing to a leak output file, especially if like it goes into an infinite loop and you aren't expecting that. So there's this dash I option. Which you still need to specify a file to run on, which is called interactive mode. And it says, it just stops after every cycle. So here it says, just started, this is what's happening in the first cycle. This is the state, initial state, and what happens. And you press enter, it goes on to the next cycle. You press enter, and so on. And you can combine that with dash D. So this is sort of our closest equivalent of a debugger. So you can step cycle by cycle and look at what's going on, which you know you might find more convenient. Okay. There's also a second option, which is dash Q, and dash Q only shows you the final state. So if you just want to say, does this work, dash Q is the option for you. It just shows you how things end up. So here I see that it ran for 7 cycles. If it actually like changed registers or memory, I could verify what the final value of those were. Here all I see is that the PC ends up with my bad, bad, bad value because I didn't actually have a case for halt in my MUX. And otherwise, everything else is unchanged because I didn't change memory or registers. We haven't talked about how you do that yet. Okay, so any questions about running HCLRS, bugging features, so on? Okay, so that's there. Quiet mood. Okay. So that's sort of the basics of HCL. And as far as the basic syntax, if you read the book carefully, you'll notice some differences. So where the book has this bool or int, we just call those all wire. The book also has a weird naming convention. And in the book's implementation of HCL, a lot of those names are required. So like val c is a fixed name that they had to use. You don't have to use the names the book uses. I'm going to use them in lecture because I want to be consistent with the book, not because I think they are good names. So the book has this weird convention that names starting with val, so val A, C, E, M are 64-bit numbers. And that's sort of the logic there, where they're using those names. But I will probably use the same names, and I guess also P, when we saw for a particular component, but they're not good names. But I'm going to be consistent with the book and use them. But in your processor implementations, you can say, well, val P is a horrible name. Why don't we just call it next PC or like next instruction or something? Absolutely go ahead and do that. Okay. Also, the book has some built-in components, like an ALU, including, you know, so this is, includes condition code handling. Which we are not going to include, so they just didn't have the features to implement that easily. You're going to have to do that here. And this is one reason why we omit the overflow flag, because in the book's version, that was all handled for students. Here, you're going to have to do the little bit of work of actually processing less than greater than. appropriate. So the other things which are going to be different are how the built-in components work, but we haven't talked about this yet, except for the instruction memory, which works the same way. We have a PC input, i10 bytes output, and otherwise our components are going to be a little different. Okay. So let's talk about the various things in HTLRS, some of which we've seen. I'm just going to go through sort of in more detail the general form. So like we saw register banks, we saw declaring the PC. We didn't see this fully general form, that we only saw register banks with one register. You can define multiple registers. They each have a width and a default value. The default value doesn't have to be zero. And we will have cases later in the semester where you in fact will definitely not want the default value to be zero. Sometimes. The register banks also have two signals associated with them called stall and bubble, which are there to help you implement pipelining, which we'll talk about later in the semester. Note that the initial value is mandatory, you cannot omit it. And also, you need to always assign to these input signals somewhere. If you declare a register, you have to use it. At least set its input. Okay, so questions? Here. Okay. So we also saw wires, and we saw wires as sort of variable shorthand, and wires have some rules. And wires are the name I'm going to give to anything which can produce a signal. So all the things we've seen before are in fact wires. They're just wires which are declared other than with the wire declaration. So for example, PC, the thing we use to read from the instruction memory, that's going to be called a wire. And like if you look at error messages, you might get an error message about the PC wire. It's a wire. It's just one that's declared for you rather than you declaring yourself. The register bank inputs and outputs are wires. They're just ones which you declare by declaring the register, not by declaring each of those wires yourself. And generally, you can assign exactly once to a wire. So you can connect exactly one value to a wire, and then you can use the value on the wire multiple places to set other wires. And this, in here, I'm setting it directly. You can also set it with an expression, like we've seen for like PC plus one sort of computations. A big thing about how wires work is order doesn't matter. So these two HTL programs do the same thing. So even though in one, I'm assigning val p down here and using it up here, and the other, I'm assigning val p up here and using it in the next line, they are exactly equivalent. The way HTL works is that it's either connected or it's not. And every cycle, values go from sort of the outputs, like our register outputs, all the way through propagating wherever they need to, all the way to the inputs for things like our stat register, for example, which determines whether we go. So like we do that every cycle in whatever order needs to happen. We don't actually care about the order you write your HTL code in. It's either the thing is connected or it's not, and it can be connected anywhere in the file. It doesn't matter where. Okay, so this is probably the bigger point of confusion. This is because we're describing hardware where the wire sort of physically is connected or it isn't. These aren't like assignments. The way the HTL program gets executed is we start values at the inputs, look for where do they go next, where do they go next, where do they go next, over and over again. And when we ask where do they go next, we look at the entire program every time. So questions? Here. Okay. So another thing about wires is you notice that wires are declared with a width. And all wires have a width, even the ones that aren't declared explicitly. So our register bank inputs and outputs have the width of the register involved. the things like the instruction memory, the PC wire is 64 bits, that's just hard-coded. I10 bytes is 10 bytes, 80 bits, that's just hard-coded. And there's some rules about widths. So values have widths, and you can't assign a value of a wrong width. So this means that if I have a 32-bit wire, I can't assign it to a 64-bit wire. That is an error, a compile time error. And I can't go the other way around. I can't take a 64-bit value and assign it to a 32-bit wire. That is a compile time error. If you want to do that, you can subset the bits if you want the lower order 32 bits. But if you don't do something like that, you cannot do this assignment. It's a compile time error. It's not allowed. Okay. And in fact, all values have widths. So this means that if I do like small value plus 1, that's also an error. If I do big value 2 plus 1, that's also okay, turns out. So you might ask, how do these widths work out? So there are rules on the widths of constants. And these are sort of something which is a bit of a compromise. So normal constants, normal decimal and hexadecimal constants don't have a width, which means that when you use them, you can assign them to any width, even widths which seem too small for the value. This is so if you have a 5-bit wire, you can assign a value to it with hexadecimal and not like say, oh, that's 8 bits, and not have that be an error. Binary constants, which you can declare like this, 0b instead of 0x for binary, have a width of the number of bits they have. And that means that if you have the wrong number of bits, it won't assign. And the idea is that this helps you catch errors if you're assigning a 4-bit constant like, say, nop, to a 64-bit value, that's not going to do what you expect. So like, for example, PC equals nop. It turns out that nop is declared something like this. Nop is going to be 0B0001. So if you do PC equals nop, that's an error. And that the idea of this feature is that helps you catch bugs where PC equals nop, you're thinking, I'm making the program counter be a nop. That's not what you're doing. You're saying, execute the instruction at address 1, which is not what you want to do. And this makes those sorts of confusions an error, but it won't catch everything, because sometimes you'll have a 64-bit value that's an address versus a 64-bit value that's like a value you want to put in the register. Not going to catch that. They're both valid values. And since I'm mentioning constants here, I should point out that, we have constants. So what are our constants? And if you go to our webpage on HTLRS, which is linked on the website here, there is a giant table of constants. This is basically just included before all your code. These are declarations of constants as binary constants, so all the stat values, constants for each of the registers, constants for all the instructions like halt, nop, and so on. Now, you don't have to use any of these, but it's sure a lot handier to write capital nop instead of looking up the iCode for nop. And it's sure a lot easier to read capital NOP than say, what is instruction with iCode 1, what's instruction with iCode 2, and so on. So I recommend using these. And you can use the same syntax to define your own constants if that's something you want to do. So let's talk about more built-in components. So we've seen one two built-in components, which is our stat register and our instruction memory. And these are both things which are specific to we're building a processor and we're building a y86 processor. So for the stat register, this is a hard-coded stat signal. We call it a register because our textbook does, but we set this signal at the end of every cycle. The simulator looks at what was it, and if it's this constant stat AOK, it keeps going. If it's this constant halt, it does a normal shutdown. And there's a bunch of other error values, which will print out an error message. And this must be set. So this is one of the mandatory components. If you don't set this, you will get a compile error. We have our instruction memory. So it has an input wire, which is PC, which is 64 bits. It has an output of I10 bytes. And like our memories we talked about for reading, which is all this memory can do, this works that you put a value on PC, you get a value in I10 bytes in the same cycle, so you can immediately, you know, as long as you set PC, other code can use I10 bytes based on how that's set. And it's always 10 bytes. If you have a less than 10 byte instruction, you're just not going to use all the bits, like the examples we've seen with NOP. Like, we load 10 bytes, we look at the I code, we decide, oh, it's enough, I'm not going to do anything else. We load 10 bytes, we look at the I code, we say, oh, it's a jump, I'm going to use 8 bytes of it for the destination, and it turns out I'm ignoring the last byte, that's fine. Then we have the register file. So you've seen in our output that we have RAX and so on always being output. So there's this built-in register file that's always there. And it has a bunch of signals to control it, and they're the same signals we talked about. So we have to input register numbers to read, and we get values out if we do that. And we have to input register numbers to write and a value to write to that. And at the end of the cycle, after we've propagated all our signals, those values will be written so they're available during the next cycle. And so these signals are all predefined. You don't have to do anything. It's not like the PC register. We don't have to define anything. It's just always there. And they have the following names, which are slightly different from our textbook. If you need to look up these names, you can look up on the course website. On that webpage, I showed you all the constants. There's also all these names, so if you don't need to memorize them, you can look up what they are. And this is true for all the other built-in wires we'll be talking about later. So we have our source register numbers. These are 4 bits because we have 4 bits to indicate which register we're talking about. A and B, and our destinations M and E, and corresponding either output values, so outputs A and outputs B. Our textbook names these like reg val A, I believe, or something like that, or val A. We have a slightly different name that indicates their input or output more explicitly. But reg output A is E, register with number source A. So if we set source A to 0, that's RAX. Reg output A will be the value that's currently in RAX. Similarly, if we set dest M to RAX and set input M to say 15, then during the next cycle, RAX will have become 15. Yeah. So the question is, can we use either of these? Absolutely. So you just have to remember that M and M are a pair and E are a pair. And they work exactly the same way. So to give an example, here's an add CPU HTL. So I declare some convenience wires, RA and RB, for my register numbers. They're 4 bits. And I also extract my I code and my iFunc, which I don't actually use. So I set the source register numbers to RA and RB from the instruction. And if you remember our brief discussion of endianness and how that maps to our I-10 bytes. It turns out that RA is bits 12 through 16, and RB is bits 8 through 12. So I extract those, and I set registers A and registers B. So during the same clock cycle, we're going to get into reg output A and reg output B those values, and I just add those together to produce my input to the register file. And then I want to write that to RB, so I set destination E to that. And that's what we end up writing. Yes?
But why did
we
increment the PC by 2?
Why did I increment the PC by 2? So this is running the actual Y86 add queue instruction. And if you remember the encoding of that, I believe it was 6, 0 is our first byte. I'm not actually sure that it's a 6. And then RA, RB was our second byte. So this is 2 bytes, and that's where the 2 here comes from. Notice that I extract the I code, but don't actually use it. Okay, other questions? So we can think of this as representing, if we remember our register file here, we have RA is this first source input, RB is the second, so our output A is the value of that register. I'm using the notation of treating an array of registers R, it's index source A into that and source B, and we're going to take those values, we're going to add them together, and we're going to send that around to our next value input, which we're going to write to this. So one thing you might wonder about is, well, I didn't use dest m, so what happens with it? And the rule is that unlike other wires, these built-in components, if you don't use them, they have a sensible default value. So since we didn't set dest m, it's going to default to none, to the none register number, which is 15. And as long as you don't mention it, that happens. So this means that if you have code which never sets registers, you don't never touches dest m or input m, it's fine. If you use either of them, you need to set both of them. Okay, so questions about our register file hookups? So the one remaining component we need is our data memory. So data memory, we're going to have representatives of all the signals we saw before. So we have a control for whether we read or write. So we have that read enable, write enable. We also have a control for what address we're reading from or writing to, and the value we're writing if we're writing a value, and the value we just read if we're reading a value. So these have the following names, which again you can look up on the course webpage rather than memorizing. So we have our address, and this is the address input into the data memory, which is used for either reading or writing depending on the read and write enable signals, which are these read bit and write bit, which are 1-bit wires, 0 to say don't read or don't write, 1 to say do read or do write. We have our input value, which only matters if we're reading. And we have our output value, which only matters, input value, which only matters if we're writing. We have our output value, which only matters if we're reading. So this is named from the, input of the memory and output of the memory is the perspective they're named from. So the input value is where you put the input you want to send to the data memory. The output is where you get the output of the data memory. So this means for reading, remember our memory is like our instruction memory, it works in the same cycle. So if you've put a value on memadder and set enabled reading, then memoutput will be set because you set memadder to the value in memory at that address. Similarly for writing, you need to set the address input and the input to say, I want to write to this address, and you enable writing, and then memory will be updated for the next cycle. So if you're reading from memory at the same time for some reason, for example, maybe you're writing to the place where the data, where the instruction memory is reading from, then it won't take effect until the next cycle. Yeah. So the question is, do you have to explicitly say read or write is zero? So like our, so if you use, I think the rule is that if you use the output signal, you need to set write read bit. And if you use the input signal, you need to set write bit. I'm not actually sure if that's true. If you don't use them, don't use the input or output signal, they default appropriately. So you can write code which never touches the data memory, like the not jump CPU we saw earlier. But if you use them, you should set them. And certainly when we're making any processor which does anything with writing memory, you definitely want to have that controlled, because you know most instructions don't write memory. So you don't, and if you don't set mem write bit, you're telling it all instructions are going to write memory. It's like what you're trying to imply by setting mem input. Okay, other questions? Okay, so we mentioned that one built-in component that the textbook had that we don't is an ALU, but this is not really a problem. So you can just implement that with a MUX. So we have the flexibility to do that. The textbook like really constrained in their implementation of HCL, really constrained defining new wires. We don't do that, so like this is all something you can do, which is why we don't have you have a built-in ALU component. You can write it yourself. You can decide, I don't want to have, I want to check the I code instead of ALU op or something else. You have choices. The textbook also makes a bunch of design choices, which you may or may not do. So for example, in our textbook, they've made a decision that any time a value comes from memory, it goes to the M port of the register file. Any time a value comes from the ALU, it goes to the E port of the register file. This is why they chose the names. And this was kind of required in the textbook's HCL implementation. You don't have to do that. Like, I might follow that convention to be more consistent with the textbook, but you absolutely don't have to do that. They have some instructions where they decided, you know, to add 8 or subtract 8 from RSP, and they use the ALU for that rather than like a separate adder. You don't have to do that sort of organization. For our processor assignments, are going to be testing that your processor executes instructions correctly and does so with the same timing. So like one instruction per cycle right now. That's what we're going to check. And that you use the supply registers in memory, because that's how we know whether you did the right thing, is by looking at what are the values of memory, what are the values of registers after. Okay. So some other notes on our built-in components. So we saw that we had an assembler called YAS in our tools directory. Our tools had this YAS. There's also this thing called YIS, which is an interpreter. So it's a reference implementation in C of Y86. So for example, I just ran my not jump CPU on a program. I found out it took 7 cycles. I can also run YIS on that same program,
y and see what happens. And it's going to tell me that it took 7 steps, that the last PC was 1E, which I didn't do correctly. Not that it matters what the PC is when we're halted. And it also told me the values of the condition codes and the reference implementation, that there were nothing changed in the registers. They all had their initial values of 0, and there was nothing changed in memory. It all had the initial values loaded from the .yo file. But this is something you can use if you have an assembly file, including one maybe that you wrote yourself, and you want to say, what is it supposed to do? This can tell you what it's supposed to do. You should also, of course, you know, if you need to, be able to figure that out yourself. But, you know, maybe that's not, you know, a thing that your LLMs are going to count on doing correctly. Okay, so so that's everything I think I need to talk about HCL, which is also lab this week and homework after that. So we have these wires. Some of them are built in. Some of them are defined because you define things like registers. And the essential structure is you declare wires or assign things to wires from other wires, possibly computing values. We have our special MUX syntax, which is sort of our if-else statement. This is how we make decisions. Usually our test will be things like if the I code, the current instruction is a NOP or whatever. That would be this type of thing we are testing. We can define register banks with this syntax with a input letter and an output letter with the lowercase uppercase convention, which right now we're basically only going to use for the program counter. So we'll have a whole bunch of extra stuff we want to put in register banks like this later on. And we also have some fixed functionality. So we have our register file, which has 15 registers and 2 read and write ports, as our textbook calls them. So a register file port is something which lets you read or write one value. So a read port lets you read one value from the register file. Write port lets you write one value. We have our memories, separate data and instruction, and these access actually the same actual memory, even though they have separate inputs. We'll talk later in the semester about why are they separate components on our pictures if they're accessing the same memory. And we have our stat pseudo register, which is how we indicate whether the assembler keeps going. So any questions on HCL? Okay. Okay, so something we've seen a bit and we talked about last time was that our textbook divided things up into these stages, which right now are just a convenience thing. And we can see part of the convenience here is that I can actually write, sort of write this code in separate stages and sort of have it match up to what our textbook is doing. Probably I should have made this decode part start here. And this is all fetch. But we can divide up our HCL code into stages, and maybe this makes it easier to write the HCL code, because like when I'm writing the execute part, I'm just thinking about what does the ALU do for this instruction? And I say, oh, it adds the values it got from the register from the decode stage where it read from registers. And maybe that's an easier way of writing it. And our textbook has descriptions of the instructions that divide things up by stages. And one way you can go about building a processor given these sorts of descriptions is you can just go through each of these lines and say, oh, that's just some HCL code. So for example, we have this funny notation, M1, that means 1 byte from memory at a particular place. So this says use the PC to read 1 byte from memory. In HCL, this means that we're taking the instruction memory, because it's the fetch stage, taking 1 byte out of that and splitting it up into something we're going to call for later, iCode and iFun. In this diagram, this list of stages, turns out we don't use those values, but we could still write HCL code, which like sets an iCode wire and an iFun wire that we might care about later. We also have an example down here of in PC update of PC ends up being val p. And this is our textbook's notation for putting a value on the input wire to the PC register. So this is going to turn out to be whatever, if we have our register PP of the PC 0, this means that we're doing p, little p, the PC equals val p, is that's what it corresponds to. And the assumption is that we're doing that after we've earlier on set val p based on the output of the PC register. So here this is our val p equals big P, the PC plus 1. So you can see that this sort of has a one-to-one correspondence with our HCL. So this might be a reasonable way of going about writing HCL or checking that if you've written something that it actually makes sense in a very systematic way. Now, this notation is a bit weird for how it expresses some other things. So here is the stages for our not jump CPU that as our textbook would write them. So we have things which make sense. So we're loading our iCode and iFun as part of i10 bytes. And we're also loading val c, our jump destination, as part of those i10 bytes. Note that it starts at PC plus 1, and it's m sub 8, so it's 8 bytes starting 1 byte into the PC, which turns out to be bits 8 through 72 of i10 bytes. And we also set val p. And then we have two conflicting instructions down here. So it says in this NOP column, we set the PC register's input to val p. In this jump column, we set it to val c. And what you can think of this as saying is, oh, we have a mux. Depending on what instruction it is, either we use val c or val p. So our code in HCL, this is going to correspond to our C, this is our the PC register input equals, and if the iCode is NOP, we're going to have val p, and if the iCode is jump, we're going to have val c. So this corresponds, when you look at all of them together, to directly to HCL, and just every time we need to make a choice, we have a mux here. Every time we have these two columns conflict, we know we need a mux. And we can think of this sort of corresponding to just our old jump CPU we saw earlier, with just some wires a little named differently. And they didn't like explicitly talk about this mux existing, but you could imply it from the two instructions doing different things. And they didn't talk about this logic box here, but we just implement that as part of our mux, sort of because we set the conditions that's figured out for us, is the idea when if we took our HCL and compiled it to hardware. Okay, so any questions so far? So our textbook's stages also have ways of expressing sort of accessing registers in memory. I'm just going to go through what that looks like so you know what's going on. So we have here an assignment from this pseudo array R of registers. So in HCL, this corresponds to, well, I need to use the register file to read that. So I need to set my source register number, so probably reg source A, and use that to set a valet, which is going to be reg output A, the corresponding output. That corresponds to doing that in HCL. Note that here we, our MR move queue instruction doesn't have that line because we don't need to read from RA for this instruction. That is perfectly fine, but we could read from RA as we discussed earlier. As long as we don't use the value, it's harmless. So I don't necessarily need a mux here to decide what to do. So our textbook uses the same syntax to represent reading from the instruction memory as the data memory. The way we distinguish from a listing like this of which one are we doing is just, are we in the memory stage or the fetch stage? If we're in the memory stage, then something like this means write 8 bytes to memory at address val E. So we need to set memadder, the address input to the data memory, to val E. And write val A, so we need to set its input to val A, and we also need to do a write enable. That's what this is telling us needs to happen for the RMoveQ instruction. And we have the opposite for the MRMoveQ instruction. This says set the address wires to val E, same thing as RMoveQ, but assign the output of the data memory, so assign mem output to val m, which is the name we'll use later on. We also represent writing to a register. So here we say set one of the register inputs to val m. The textbook's convention, we would set input m to val m, and we also need to set the register number, so we're saying we're setting dest m to ra. So questions about how these stages correspond to sort of the most straightforward HCL code you could produce from them. Okay. So something to note is that our textbook's descriptions of the processor omit, so first of all, we have a bunch of things renamed. So let's just start with that. So our textbook just has a weird naming convention where we haven't had to name these things before. So val C is what they call an immediate from the instruction. Val A and B are what they call the two values you read from the register file. Val E is the output of the ALU. Val M is the output of memory. Val P is this value here. Those are those names. They've just chosen that convention for some reason. Also, we have lots of signals here which don't actually explicitly show up on those listings of instruction stages. And this is commonly called the control path for the instruction. Because we can think, look at this convert opcode and these signals that make the mux do what they need to do. They don't actually contain values from the instruction. They just contain control information. And the same is true of our write enable and read enable signals for data memory. We don't actually send values from the instruction. And commonly people will talk about the data path and the control path. So we have the data path of our processor, which is everything I didn't highlight here. And that's where the data that the instruction is processing goes. And we have our control path, which is what makes the data go to the right places. This isn't a hard line. We're not going to ask you what's part of the control path and the data path in the tricky cases. So for example, are the condition codes part of the control path? Well, it depends who you ask. Like, they're kind of data set by the instruction. Like, you can retrieve them later. They're part of the state of the processor, and they're persistent. But they also like are used for conditional decisions, kind of like what do we write to this register. So you might hear different opinions. But a general thing that will happen is that the textbook, when it's describing instructions, it's not going to tell you what the control path does. You know, it's just going to say, this is what the instruction does, and the control path needs to happen so the instruction executes that way. When we draw processors, we'll often omit parts of the control path. So when I'm drawing processors, I'm not going to draw this convert opcode box typically. I'm just going to draw the muxes, and you're going to say, well, there's something controlling them. That's our control path, which is going to be based presumably mostly on the opcode, but I'm not going to draw it. Just to keep drawing simpler, and this is a common thing you'll see when people describe processors, is that they won't draw these control signals. Okay, so questions on our notion of control paths. Okay, so since we looked at our textbook description of stages, let's just systematically walk through what happens in each stage, including like the interesting cases. So our textbook's instruction fetch does two things. It computes the address of the next instruction, the one that follows in memory, which might not be the next instruction executed. For example, if it's a jump, this is the instruction after the jump in the assembly. It's not the instruction that will run next. It also splits up values into separate wires. A subtlety is our textbook calls valC both the target of a call and a move or a jump and the move displacement, even though these are in different parts of the instruction. But it splits up the instruction as part of the job. And so this is a picture following our convention that I'm not going to draw control signals anymore. So I didn't draw the iCode or iFun. Those are going to be all control signals. I'm only drawing the data path of our instruction. So after instruction fetch, we have our valP, our next instruction address, and our valC, our constant from the instruction, and we have RA and RB, our two register numbers. Our next step is decode, and as I mentioned before, decode is where we read registers. And we get our register values, which our textbook calls val A and val B. In HCL, we see that they're called reg output A, reg output B. So the obvious way to build that is that we just connect source A to RA, source B to RB. And this works mostly, but there are some problems. So the push instruction needs to access memory based on the stack pointer. And the stack pointer, well, we could push the stack pointer. It could be push RSB. But probably not. Probably it's like push RAX. And if you look at the push instruction, it's going to be something like A, I believe, A, 0, and F, and let's say if it's push RAX 0, this is push RAX. Like that's not going to, none of those parts of the instruction, you know, RA is not the address of RSP and RB isn't. So we need to actually read from RSP eventually, so we need to get that in. So we're going to have a mux something like this. And we also need to read from RSP for call and return, because those need to write to the stack. In order to know where to write to, what address to send to the data memory, we need the value of RSP. Our current plan is that we're not going to have you implement these instructions this semester. We've usually done it in the past. But our textbook certainly talks about it. So they need to have this decision. Do we use RB or RSP? And something you might do is you might say, well, for halt, not conditional jump, and things like that, we don't actually read registers. So we should not actually pass a real register number to the register file. We learned that register number 15 is special and means that we don't read a register and we get 0. And you absolutely can just pass this non-register to it, but it's not strictly necessary because we don't technically care if there's the value of some random register on an output. We're not going to use it. But that's an option. Okay. So questions on procedure here. And note that I went through this systematic process where I wanted to figure out what happens for all these instructions. I just made a table. That's a way you can figure this out. Just go through all the instructions, see that you know what happens for each of them. Okay, so that's our decode. Now with a special little RSP there to handle that case of push, pull, call, pop, return. So then we have our execute stage. So in our execute stage, we're going to take our two values here, and we're going to perform an ALU operation. In our textbook, we have val e be computed by the ALU. And we also, this is where we handle condition codes. And we'll talk about, when we talk about pipelining, a very good reason we handle condition codes in the execute stage, even though you might say, well, we're using them for a conditional move, shouldn't we handle that in write back? And we're using them for a conditional jump, shouldn't we handle that in PC update? There's a good reason we're doing it in execute that will come up when we talk about pipeline. And in our textbook, they had this as a built-in component. So they just talk about, there's a con signal which just deals with this. You're going to have to produce this logic yourself that decides, oh, given the condition codes, are the conditions met for the current instruction? If it's a jump less than, is less than actually true based on our condition codes? And this amounts to some control logic where we basically have a mux where we say what's happening and control, for example, for conditional move, either we're going to end up writing to no register or to the register specified in the instruction. And that's going to be based on what type of condition codes the conditional move is. Is a conditional move less than, conditional move less than equal, and so on, to control that. Okay, so questions on this logic here? And in our textbook's design, this happens in the, you know, all this logic here happens in the execute stage. And there's a good reason for that. Though it's not obvious why that needs to happen now. So we're not going to draw the condition codes on our picture. We're going to consider them kind of part of the control path. So I'm going to draw my data path without them. So I just have my ALU, which is taking in my two inputs, and the operation to perform. Okay, so let's think about this. So I have a bunch of instructions listed here. For which of these instructions are we in trouble? So something I've done already done turns out to be a problem for at least one of these instructions, where I'm going to have real problems making that instruction work correctly, given the wires I've already drawn. Someone tell me about any one issue I might have. Okay. Anyone have any one of these instructions they think is probably going to be problematic, given what I've already drawn? No one? Yeah, back there. The knob. So what's the problem with knob? So the obvious complaint is knop doesn't add anything or subtract anything, and it seems like we're doing that. And that is a good complaint. The way we're going to deal with things like knop generally is that, well, this ALU is going to do something, and we're just going to make sure that in the future wires I draw, that there's some way that this value that comes out here won't do anything bad. But there's some instructions where we actually care about the value that comes out here, and we're going to have the wrong one. Yeah. Pop. So what's the problem with pop?
You're not going to have the right value from this one. But like, you're not going to be able to like get the value from
the RSP. OK. So for pop, we need to compute a value based on RSP. And it seems like we need to do that with the ALU. That's what we said we were going to do. And if we already wired up the ALU like this, we can't add or subtract 8 from RSP. We have the same problem with call. Okay, any other cases? Everything else look good? So let's write our MR move Q instruction. So MR move Q DRB into RA. Or DRA. See the problem? So remember what's going to happen for our memory instructions is that we're going to compute a memory address with our ALU, which is the only component we want to do that. And we're going to use that to control the address we read from. And for our memory to register move, we want to compute that based on the displacement in the instruction, which is sitting on this val C wire up here, which is not connected to our ALU in any way. We need to fix that. So for our memory to register move, we need to actually be able to take val C and send it into the ALU. So it's not always the same. Sometimes it should be val A and ALU A. Sometimes we have a displacement plus a register, so we need to handle that. Sometimes we have constants from constant 8 that we need to add or subtract for our stack instructions. So these are cases where we can't just connect the values like we think of for like the add instruction. So now we have our actual execute stage where we take our value, either a value from the immediate, from the instruction, or displacement, or we take a register value, or we take 8, and we add it to another, add or subtract, or XOR it with another register value. Then we have the memory stage, where we need to read or write data memory, and our textbook, because it writes the way it writes the stages, it doesn't explicitly name the input signal and the output signal, though in HCL, you need to figure that out. But our common case is that we compute an address with the ALU, and we write RA into that address. This is like for our memory to register move. sorry, register to memory move works that way, for example. So for which instructions are we, do we have an exception though? So this happens to work for NOP, because for NOP, we're going to just have our not enable writes. That's not a problem. And for rmoveq and mrmoveq, we have the write set up. We're just going to not enable writes for one of them, enable reads for the other, assuming I didn't mess up order. Pop is actually a problem. Because for pop, we want to compute a new RSP but read from the old one. So we need a bypass for pop. So for pop, we need to have a bypass for that. And for call, it's a problem because we want to write valp. So we need a way of sending valp all the way over here. So we have some special cases there. Note that, fortunately for this, the only special cases really are the ones where we have stack instructions, so which we will deal with last, and if we deal with them at all. So then we end up with something like this. And then we have our write back stage, where we're going to actually write registers. And most commonly, we're going to write the ALU output to destination E, which is usually going to be RB, and the memory output to destination M, which is RA. So where do we have problems here? Note that this is our textbook's convention. As I mentioned earlier, you don't have to do this. This is what our textbook does. Is that it writes ALU output to E, M memory output to M. That's where the names come from. But of course, there are some exceptions here. So what instructions are we in trouble for here? Someone tell me any one of them. Yeah. MR move Q. Why MR move Q? I agree, we are in trouble. So to write it back to the correct register. So it turns out, assuming that this is connected to our, assuming we have the write register hooked up, which I may have not done, that would work. But I haven't been clear which register it is. But there's a bigger problem, which comes up with mrmoveq. Okay, let's think of NOP. What should NOP write to registers? Tell me. Nothing. Does this write nothing to registers for a NOP? Probably not. So we need to have some extra control signals there to be able to write nothing. I don't think we actually need. The other thing is that sometimes we need to write a constant to memory for constant to registers for iremoveq, and there are two strategies for dealing with this. One of which is to have a mux down here, that can take the constant or the register value that we're copying into RB. The other of which is to have the ability to add zero and take the ALU output. This is what our textbook chooses. You don't have to do it that way. Okay, so that's all I have for today. So next time we'll finish this up and then talk a little about pipelining.